Mr. Murray Lee, real four.
KGB using women, and plenty of examples of this in the post-war years. And of course, the corny one of Mata Hari in the First World War. We used women in London to help debrief certain people who came back from Europe. I remember one weekend, later on, must be 1942, an American who'd been working in the Vichy American office or chargé d'affaires, whatever it's called, to the legation to the Vichy government, came back via Spain and Portugal, and I met him and took him to Grosvenor House and entertained him, and I took one of our girls along, and her brief was to spend the weekend with him, see what she could find out before he went back to America. He talked fast. So we kept her there for 2 or 3 days because he was very interested. And it was very interesting. We got all the up-to-date dirt on Vichy, which was very important to us in 1942.
So you...
I think you would probably describe this girl as an enthusiastic amateur. Times haven't changed, have they?
So you were discussing your work with the field security agents and the selection of agents.
That's right. And so when we were, when we were interviewing them, we had to try and sense whether or not they were going to be able to do this particular type of work. They also had to be slightly unorthodox people. We weren't keen on... bureaucratic minds.
Why was that?
Too stereotyped. The people they were dealing with were all what we called funnies. So they were individuals in their own right. They were not interested in parade ground work and bullshit and all that sort of thing. But they were people who had tremendous self-discipline and were prepared to work for long periods on their own. And that is what our NCOs had to do. They were working for 13 weeks on their own, nobody to guide them, nobody to turn to if they couldn't remember what they ought to do. They had to know their stuff, and they had to pick it up, and they had to use their intelligence all the time. And they never knew what sort of situations they would be faced with.
You said that... Did any pure Frenchman refuse to work with the Free French? Was there an example of that?
We've got to go back to 1941-42 and the job that I was doing. We were in the security section. We had a particular job to do, which was reporting to the country sections on the mental and physical characteristics of their agents. We were not concerned with their politics. We were not concerned with their operational efficiency. It didn't matter to us whether they were good or bad at blowing up things or sticking knives into people. We were entirely concerned with their personalities. Now, the other thing was that under no circumstances were any of us in the security section ever to inquire about the background of any of the agents that they were with. We never inquired about what operations they were going on, because we always worked on the need to know. The only information we had or wanted was that information which enabled us to do our job. Whether a man was going to be dropped into Lyon or Berlin or Rome was absolutely irrelevant. There was nothing. It was not in our nothing to do with us whether where he went. We didn't want to know what his operations were. That was entirely to do with the country sections. That was their job, any more than they wanted to know how we got to know information about their agents in training. All they wanted to know was the result. They didn't want to know how it happened. so that if any of us were caught, and none of us knew whether we were going to be sent abroad or not, we were sitting in Baker Street at the time, because there was nowhere else to sit. And this was long before El Alamein or anything like that. We were doing pinprick raids on across the Channel. There was no signs of a second front in 1941. But at any time, any of us might have gone on some sort of operation. We might have got caught. So the less you knew about other people's work, the better. This is all part and parcel of this security clerk. So I eventually got together an extremely good team with three very good officers. And out of the 39 people that I originally had, I got commissions for 36 of them before the war was over. And three of them became majors alongside me. Because I was a major for 4.5 years, actually. But then I remained a major for 4.5 years because I always said exactly what I thought. And that doesn't bring a promotion in the army. Coming back to the first days in SOE, when I got there, I had to sign the Official Secrets Act. We all did. And unlike this young woman who's just been given 6 months for signing the Official Secrets Act and then blowing a couple of secret documents to the press, when we signed the Official Secrets Act, it meant just that we did not discuss outside our organisation anything to do with the work that we were doing. Neither were we allowed to communicate in any form, written or verbal, anything to do with our work. And we knew that if we did, we would go straight inside. Sometime in 1942, we found a captain in the Black Watch who was working in one of the operational sections, who was a member of the Communist Party, which we didn't know. Or if he wasn't a member of the party, he certainly had communist or Russian sympathies. He thought it was a very good idea to send a copy of our daily war diary to the Russian embassy. We thought that was rather bad news. And the man who ran the security department, the director of John Center, asked him out to have a drink at the RAG. That's the Senior Army Navy Club, and broke him down over two very stiff gins and tonics. He was court-martialed and got 7 years, which he richly deserved. But I suppose, nowadays, the press would say that he was perfectly entitled to send anything he wanted to the Russians because they were our allies. It's a sort of idiotic thinking that you get involved in nowadays.
So he was a regular Black Watch officer, was he?
Wartime. Got 7 years. There were a lot of court-martials. There was one Pearl I remember from the who was at the finishing schools. Brilliant man. I think he got a VC. Tough, charming. And he was sent on one of these training exercises from the New Forest. They used to drop them 150 miles away and tell them they'd got to penetrate a telephone exchange or something of that sort without getting caught. I mean, whatever it might be, it might have been an aerodrome or something of that sort. And if they were caught, they were under no circumstances to tell anybody what they were really doing. They were merely to ask the police or the unit that had caught them to ring up a certain number in the War Office. And this silly clot, when he got caught, blew the gaff, said exactly where he'd come from, what he was doing, and so on. He got court-martialed, but I can't remember, I think he was exonerated for some reason, rather because of his war record.
Why should he have done something like that?
God knows. Well, you see, people's attitude towards security is a very personal thing, and some people simply don't understand. They don't understand that if they tell the police where their finishing training schools are in the New Forest and what they were doing and why they'd been recruited and what they were going to do, that the chap they're talking to has got friends and a wife and all this. He tells her and it goes on and on and on till eventually everybody in England knows where the finishing schools are. And sooner or later, the enemy's going to hear about it.
But
bound to.
He'd been specifically warned not to do so.
Yes. Everybody signed the Official Secrets Act. All warned. Now, when I joined SOE, there was, apart from signing the Official Secrets Act, in Baker Street, there was no, for want of a better word, security Bible for new recruits, male and female, to read at their leisure after they'd been taken on. It's all right. You can imagine, well, me. I'd been security trained. And even when I went to Baker Street, it was like walking into a sort of super spy story and the sort of thing you read about, your eyes popping out on stalks when you're at a prep school, the sort of thing that I'd suddenly become involved in. Well, without training on how to handle this, and without some sort of brief, how can you work out your own cover stories so that you're discreet, or you don't say the wrong thing, or you don't go bright scarlet when somebody suggests you're in the Secret Service? There was nothing. So soon after I joined, I started to write what I've just called a security Bible. This eventually ran to 27 pages. And it covered every aspect of SOE's work. It went into considerable detail about how to build up your own cover story so that if your own work was secret, there were bound to be people who knew what you were actually doing. So you had to know who all those friends were. Then you had to say, well, all those friends who know what I'm actually doing have got to say, oh, yes, I need something to do with the War Office. What are you doing? Then you'd have to build up your cover story, and then that outside perimeter would have another bunch of friends. And so this rainbow of circles would go out until eventually you got into civilian life, where this cover story became so opaque that whatever was said would never lead back to Baker Street. And that's how we worked it out. And it was at this time that we concocted this War Office Department cover, MO1SP, because lots of operational officers in the country sections couldn't very well talk about Baker Street because the whole of their background was at least regimental, and therefore to be in a military operational department of the War Office was quite plausible. So mysterious operations in secret places came up, which again, of course, we told people what we thought were rather funny translations, because after all, we used to joke about these things. Internally in the organisation, SOE was always known as the Stately Homes of England, because all our training schools were in Stately Homes. And Audley End and Hathrop Castle, Erisegg House, Camus Derrick. What is it? There was another, Longrendon. There was another one at Tame. Wanborough Manor off the Hog's Back. They were dotted around all over the place, and they were known to me by numbers. I eventually knew what their addresses were, but we always used to call them SDS1 or 25 or 50 or whatever it was. Station 9. Oh, that's right, yes. Station 9 was the place where they developed all sort of nasty, horrible things that went bump in the night. You've probably heard about Vespa motor scooters.
Yes.
And these little Honda things that people run around in. Well, those all originated in Station 9, which was in Hertfordshire, near Welling. It was called a well bike. It was a collapsible motorbike. The whole thing folded up and went into a parachute container, and we used to drop these things down to the agents. And after the war, the Vespa people in northern Italy, to whom a lot of these well bikes had been dropped to the partisans in northern Italy, and Vespa got onto this thing, and they built this motorbike, and they were the first motor scooters that penetrated into Europe. Of course, since then, it's been copied.
Well bikes?
Well bike, W-E-L hyphen B-I-K-E. Of course, well for Welin. The Frith, the name of this house where all these things were invented, was near Welin. All sorts of things. Lumps of manure which blew up when you ran over them. They were wonderful. And triangular nails, which agents who were trying to escape from the Gestapo used to chuck them out of the window of their car and puncture all the cars as they went along. But explosive turds were really very exciting. And they developed a wonderful torpedo that it was a sort of one-man submarine which could be piloted to within, I think it was a mile of its target. And then the torpedo could be detached from the carriage, and the torpedo ran along the surface until it got within 200 yards, and then it submerged to 3 feet. And it was practically undetectable. Oh, there are all sorts of gadgets and things that there. And James Bond, I know that man that James Bond goes to see. Well, I mean, it was that sort of thing.
But you had no first-hand experience of Station 9.
Well, I used to go down and see that the security was all right. Station 12 was another one where all the explosive sabotage courses took place, and I went down there on a course once. Very boring. I'm not awfully good with things like that, and I'm absolutely hopeless at one unarmed combat or firing a revolver. And if I was a cowboy, I'd be the chap who would be biting the dust, because I'm so slow at that sort of thing. You've got to know your own limitations in life. And it was no good me going on operations, because I'd have been no bloody good at all. I'd have been rubbed out in no time.
How you described your duties when you arrived at SOE at Baker Street, but how did your duties and your career develop during the time you were at Baker Street?
Well, I joined in June 41 under Wetmore, who gave me completely free rein to run the military security side of it as best I could, and I had to build up the whole thing from scratch. In September 41, MI5, I don't know who arranged this, but a chap called John Center, who was a barrister, was sent to us from MI5, and with him came a chap called General Lakin. Now, General Lakin was quite a character. He'd known Lawrence of Arabia. He was very old, very tall man, and he was colonel of two Indian regiments, and he'd been in censorship. And I remember soon after he joined us, I was talking to him. He was a real sort of pucker sob. I was talking to him one day, and he said, "Do you know, my boy, when I first joined the censorship, there were 33 files. And by the time I left, 3 years later, there were 33,000. It's quite remarkable progress." So I thought, well, this is rather strange. But anyway, he was a sort of titular head, Major General Lakin. Very nice man. And I remember to this day when the news came through that we'd got Heydrich, because we trained two Czech agents who were dropped into Czechoslovakia, and they got Heydrich. He was an absolute bastard, this man. A homosexual bastard of the First Order. And he was... a lot of people like that ought to be liquidated, there's no doubt about it. They got him, and the tragedy was that these two got away. And they were caught about a week later in what the Italians called a rastrellamento. What the Germans did was to seal off each end of a street. And they then shot everybody, men, women, and children who were caught in the street. No trial, in the end, just shot. And these two boys were caught in one of these rastrellamentos afterwards. There has been a film about it. I can't remember what it's called, and I think I'm right in saying it's quite inaccurate, because they show these two chaps sort of fighting it out to the last in a cellar, and that not so. As far as our information came through, was that they were caught in one of these cleanups. Very brave chaps. But I remember the night he told me, this old boy was sort of doing a sort of fandango around his office in Baker Street. He was so excited.
About the assassination of
Heydrich. And, but John Senter, a very clever man, and he gradually, there was a tremendous clash of personalities between he and Wetmore. And eventually Wetmore, who was by then a half-colonel, this was October, I went home on leave sometime in October, and when I came back I found Wetmore had been given the boot. And he eventually, I think, finished. I met him in Gibraltar when I went out to North Africa. But it was an absolute tragedy. Everybody adored Wetmore in SOE, and nobody liked Senter very much. He was a very shrewd, tough, self-made barrister. Very clever man. Nice wife.
Why was Wetmore given the boot, though?
It was clash of personalities. And also, I never knew what Wetmore's background was, but you see, as SOE developed, so the security side became more and more important. And the integration with SOE's security side had to be very closely interwoven with MI5 activities and also SIS activities on the security side of both organizations. And it was terribly important that there shouldn't be any overlapping between the two. See, my job, I had to assume that anybody in SOE on the staff side or any agent had been completely cleared from a security point of view before they joined us, so that we were only concerned with their security after they joined us. We had to assume that we had not been penetrated by the Germans, because any alien who joined us went through the Royal Patriotic Schools as soon as they came to England, where they were interrogated by MI5, and there was a very detailed screening process. And anybody who volunteered to join SOE or was recruited by SOE was very, very stringently vetted and interrogated before they came anywhere near us. So our security section had to assume that these chaps were all in the clear, male and female.
Did you ever suspect that you were penetrated by the Germans?
No.
Do you think that you were?
No. Not in England.
Why are you so sure?
It would have come out in books after the war, and it's like London calling the North Pole. You know, the Gestapo or the Abwehr got hold of one of our Dutch radio operators, and then they controlled the whole of the SOE operation from Holland for 2 years or something like that. And that was because the Dutch section didn't take any notice of a security check that came through. Now, you can criticize people till you're black in the face over that. The French section, Maurice Buckmaster's section, has been criticized for missing security checks. But you've got to put yourself in the position of a radio operator in our radio receiving stations at 3 a.m, getting a garbled message, no security check, from somebody whose operation she knew exactly, because the people who were receiving the messages always worked with the agents before they went out, so that they could read, like you can read a typewriter, the way, or like somebody plays a piano, you can tell that's Mosé's playing. So they knew that it was Gaston or Roger or Pauline or whatever it was on the other end. Well, now, if they'd been caught, they were always given a security check to work into the message, which would seem quite ordinary to the Germans who were controlling it. They wouldn't notice it. But agents are strange people. They're individuals, and a lot of them you say, oh, bollocks, this, you see. They didn't bother to put it in. Well, if you assume that every message that came through which hadn't got its security check in, was, the check was under control, you would have had to shut down half the radio stations in Europe. And we had a hell of a lot working. And there were hundreds of messages coming through. And then they used to, they were working under duress because they probably had radio direction finders closing in on them while they were sending their messages. Not only did they have to get the message across, but they also had to pack up and get away before the DF people, the Gestapo, got onto them. So, you know, when you're running a more set in those conditions, it's not altogether easy to be 100% efficient. And so, people like Maurice Buckmaster and Vera Atkins in the French section, or Jerry Morrell, used to get these garbled messages in the middle of the night on something which was vitally important. And they had to make a snap decision. Is this under control or not under control? Terribly difficult. So easy in 1984 to write a book and say what clots they were. They ought to have known. That's absolute nonsense.
We've rather lost sight of a question I asked you earlier about the way in which your duties and career developed in SOE.
Well, we got to the clash of personalities between Centre and Wetmore, and Centre got the boot. And Wetmore was returned to his depot for reposting. And his half-colonel job was broken into three G2 jobs, major jobs. And on December the 12th, 1941, I was made GSO2IB, which was a major. I was left in charge of my field security people, and was continually improving the organization and the liaison with the country sections. Who got the other jobs? Oh, Hugh Park became squadron leader. He was a barrister, brought in by John Center, charming man. And another wonderful character called Dickie Warden was a major. Even within our security section, I didn't inquire what those two were doing. And they were on much more high-level stuff than I was. They were involved with spin-offs from MI5 and SIS and things like that. Soon after I became a major, Major Charlie from Matlock, from the intelligence training place, was sent down and joined us as a half-colonel, and he became my immediate boss. And he and I worked like two peas in a pod. It was wonderful having him there. He was much older than me, and I needed somebody of that sort. So that by the end of 41... Colonel Charlie and I were running the military side of the security, and John Center and Hugh Park and Dickie Warden were doing the sort of more esoteric stuff.
How do you mean more esoteric?
Well, sort of more high-grade MI5, MI6 type of work in on the security side of our things. It's rather difficult to describe this. You've got in security, you've got physical security, which is seeing that tradesmen don't find out